The Daily Buzz is made possible with support from Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time. A trip to SMG is unlike any other entertainment experience. Whether you come early or stay late, we'll set the mood for a great night to socialize and connect with an immersive movie-going experience. And independent filmmakers, you can four-wall your film or find a home at the many film festivals they host in their 30 locations across the country. And Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency. In today's heads-down society, people crave relevance, emotional connection, and honest information. Our pioneering search-first process delivers the credible insights for informed marketing communications. You're listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW.org, MovieCityNews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This is Day 5. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location in Park City, Utah at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from the Slamdance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of the year's most important and exciting voices in the independent film world. Joining me this morning are my co-host Minji Chang and Lancia Wan, and today we will be talking about the Sundance documentaries Axida, The Battle of Standing Rock, and Quiet Heroes, as well as speaking with Joshua Rothkopf from Time Out New York, Andrew Fish from The American Cinematographer, and Jim Brunzel of Hammer to Nail and the Austin Gay and Lesbian Film Festival about their favorite films at the halfway point of Sundance. We are back on The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman, and right now we're going to do a hot topic subject. We have with us Joshua Rothkopf from Time Out New York. We have Andrew Fish from American Cinematographer. And we have Jim Brunzel, who writes for Hammer to Nail and is also the director of the Austin Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Guys, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Yeah,
thanks for having us. Yeah, we appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Okay. I was excited about this because, remarkably, with all the interviews we've been doing and things we've been talking about, we haven't been actually talking yet about the movies that have excited us this year. So you guys get that honor. So let's just dive right in. Andrew, let's go with you first. The first couple titles that really have got you going.
Let's see. So far, I've really liked Blindspotting, directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada and shot by Robbie Baumgartner. I thought it was – it's just this great movie about these two guys who are trying to deal with the gentrification of Oakland, California, where they grew up. I mean, one of them has just David Diggs plays this guy named Colin. He's just getting off of parole, and he's trying to stay out of trouble, and his troublemaking friend Miles is trying to get him back in trouble. And it covers these issues that are so tense, and there's so much, they're so important, and it's really rough to talk about, but they manage to, every time it gets really rough and just the worst you think it can get, it pops back into a terrific, entertaining comedy. Mm-hmm. So it really takes on some really important issues while entertaining at the same time. So I think it's really great.
One of those films that played, I think, first night and hit the ground running, so to speak. Josh?
Oh, well, two films are leading for me, and I mean, I've already seen like about 20, but and there's so much time left in the festival, so that's what's great about it. So this is like the halftime report.
Right.
But another opening night film that I really resonated with was Private Life. Tamara Jenkins, who did Slums of Beverly Hills and The Savages, and she has a sort of every 10 years I'll make a movie pace, and it was worth the wait. She can take as much time as she wants. This is it's a difficult film, and it doesn't seem like a comedy, but it is. It's about a couple played by Catherine Hahn, who's just revelatory in this, and Paul Giamatti, and they're trying to conceive. So it's all about IVF and donor eggs, and Tamara Jenkins really understands this subject. She went through it herself, and it's very sympathetic. It's also a heartbreaker. And the other film that I'm crazy about is called Tyrell. Did you guys hear about
Tyrell?
Yes.
Great. It's fantastic.
Okay. So Tyrell, it's Sebastian Silva, who's, you know, funny and very loose filmmaker. And he, imagine Get Out, that movie, but without the horror. It's sort of like, it's just sort of realistic. It's about a guy, he's played by Jason Mitchell from Mudbound. he goes to the Catskills with his friends and a bunch of their friends, and they all turn out to be white guys. And he feels very alienated over the course of the weekend. And it's basically just a bunch of bros kind of broing out and getting drunk. But he's beginning to feel very much like the odd man out. And so it's sort of Get Out, but rooted in a sort of realism. Mm-hmm. I thought that was fascinating. And it's also hilarious. Michael Cera's in it. And it was a kind of film that's made in 11 days. It really felt very Sundance.
Awesome. Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go with what Josh said as well. Private Life is fantastic. Tamara Jenkins, first film, like 9-10 years. And the surrogate that they bring in, their niece, is wonderful, too. I'm blanking on her name, but yeah, she's wonderful. And it really captures kind of the inu of what's going on now in parenting and the struggles that people are going through just trying to conceive and, you know, at great lengths what you will do in order to make it happen and to start a family.
I can't believe there's ever been a film about that.
Yeah. And but I mean, something that I'm like cuckoo bananas for right now is Mandy by Panos Kantamos, who made this film a few years ago called Beyond the Black Rainbow, which I think is a very decisive film, but also one that's very challenging. And I appreciate kind of those challenging films. But the lead in this is Nicolas Cage, and you know, you want to see the rapture come whenever Nicolas Cage is on screen, and you have to wait for a while, but it's very slow, it's deliberate, it's a bit self-indulgent, a little bit pretentious, but at the same time, you're watching something that, you know, you haven't seen on screen in so many years, and I've been coming to Sundance for 11 years, and I can't think of anything like it that I've seen, but it's like a cross between like an Italian giallo film, an Evil Dead film, but basically Nicolas Cage and his girlfriend or wife, played by Andrea Riseborough, she gets kidnapped by this cult, and he finds out that there is like a higher being and a bigger evil behind it, and so he just starts going after him, and once he finds out what happens to her, he just unleashes the fury.
The Cage rage.
Yeah.
I mean, he forges a sword in this film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, the scene where he's in the bathroom and he's drinking a bottle of vodka.
That's like one take. Yeah, right.
It's one take, and I hadn't laughed that hard in so long. And the music is by Johannesson.
He did Arrival, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the sound design is just incredible. And this film, I mean, it's got to be seen in a theater. It's going to lose so much if you watch it at home. And I mean, if I can see it a second time here, I've only done it one other time with another film, but I'm dying to see it again.
But if you watch it at home, you can get baked. I mean, that first hour is almost intentionally for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very retro. There's a lot of different color schemes, like voices are augmented. But yeah, I mean, the last 20, 30 minutes of it is just unreal. And
everybody's been telling me that because, you know, guys, I'm a genre guy, as everyone knows. And they've all been saying, you got to go see Mandy, like run, don't walk to the theater, because that is a John movie. And you guys are joining the chorus of that. You know, the film for me was Timeshare right now, which reminded me in a lot of ways of Escape from Tomorrow, in the nightmarish Carnival of Souls kind of thing that film had. And what was great is that I saw it the day after I saw a Shudder sponsored panel talking about horror and talking about how the doors have been blown off in every direction as far as what we actually consider horror now. And Timeshare, it couldn't have landed at a better time in my viewing schedule, because it is that. And the film is about these timeshares in like Acapulco and in Mexico, and the nightmarish world that they create for both the people that live there, the people that work within, you know, those resorts, and the families that they're trying to sell to, and it really just, it unnerves you, and it's full of like candy colors that then become oppressive, and it really fascinating movie.
That's a really good point too about how the definition of horror is sort of expanding, especially at Sundance, which you could say Sundance has sort of launched that new wave of horror when you talk about The Babadook and The Witch, and even the films that we've just talked about, like even something like Private Life or Tyrell could be called horror in a way. Right. I love that when I come to this festival now, I'm like, where's the new Babadook, you know?
Right,
Get
right.
Out was here, it was world premiered here.
Yeah, that was a sneak screening, right?
And that was actually really interesting about Terrell, because I didn't know what I was going into at all, and I didn't know if it was going to, you know, what it was going to turn into. And it was, I mean, it was wonderful as it was. It would have been wonderful if it had gone in other directions as well. And I just wanted to jump back with Terrell with the cinematography on that. It was fantastic. The handheld camera work and the intimacy of the environment that they Alexis Abe, the cinematographer, created was fantastic.
Andrew, I find it totally weird that you would bring up the cinematography again.
Well, I feel I feel it's my mandate. But yeah, I mean, then this is what we're here, American Cinematographer. I mean, to really look at the movies for the cinematography primarily. I mean, this is, and you know, doesn't get talked about enough. And we're also here to bring cinematographers together. We've hosted a couple of parties. We did something with Canon, where they're official media sponsor, and we did a party where all these wonderful filmmakers all came together. Cinematographers don't get to talk to each other. I mean, cinematographers work on their own and they run a crew. And we try to create environments where they get to do that. And we hosted another party where ICFC was our co-host, the International Collective of Female Cinematographers. And so we're just trying to get everybody together and talk. And
I'm really glad you brought that up. And I have to wrap this up. But I want to say that a couple years back, I went to the Hawaii International Film Festival, and my assignment was to kind of find out what concretely film festivals provide for filmmakers. And of course, I went there thinking, well, it's the check. Give me the check to make the next movie. And not a single filmmaker I talked to said that. Every single one said, no, put me in the room with the other filmmakers. Put me in the room with people that I will work with, that might want to hire me, that will inspire me. Just put me in the room. And that is exactly what they're talking about.
The same thing goes for critics. If I, you know, a lot of critics sort of exist in a private world where you go into a dark room and watch a movie and scurry home and write your review or whatever. But being at a film festival and putting faces to the name and really mixing it up with people and being turned on to something that maybe you weren't going to go see, and then you change your schedule. There's a community that comes to the film festivals it's very lovable.
Right. Again, I mean, this has been a great segment for Hot Topics. Again, we've been talking with Joshua Rothkopf from Time Out New York, Andrew Fish from American Cinematographer, and Jim Brunzel from Hammer to Nail, and also the Austin Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Guys, thanks for being here.
Jim, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Wild Man.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Listening to The Daily Buzz, my name is John Wildman, and right now we're going to be talking about the film Quiet Heroes. This film plays at Sundance in the doc premiere section, and we have with us right now Amanda Stoddard, who is one of the co-directors and a producer on the project, and Jared Ruga, who is one of the co-directors and executive producer on the project. So, Amanda, I'll have you start off by introducing our audience to what the film is about before we dig into it here.
Okay. So the film is about a doctor who was the only person to treat HIV and AIDS patients in Utah in the 80s and 90s in Salt Lake City. She eventually brought on her partner, Maggie Snyder, who's a physician's assistant. And with the Nuns of the Holy Cross Hospital, they were able to treat people in thousands of people in Utah at a time when it was they had to deal with a lot of stigma, a lot of shame, and a lot of ignorance that surrounded the issue of HIV.
So we're talking about Dr. Kristen Rees. Mm-hmm. And then what's fascinating about this documentary to me, and I want to hear from you, is if I'm guessing correctly, why this was something that you wanted to explore as filmmakers, is that we've seen a number of films that have dealt with AIDS crisis, HIV, from various angles and what have you. However, we have not seen it in the unlikely location of Utah, which brings with it obvious issues of politics, and in this particular case, religion, you know, that hamstrung efforts to, you know, to counteract it. Am I thinking correctly here?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this film is emblematic of what happened in a lot of the country outside of those big metropolitan areas. So it's really a film about what happened outside of New York and L.A. and San Francisco.
So how did you dig into this? I mean, you know, there's what man, what you've said and what I've said, you know, but how did you, like, you know, beyond that subject, how did you say, you know what, we found Kristen, we're gonna focus on Kristen and then expand from there? How did you really find your way into the story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's kind of a coincidental chain of events that led us to eventually make this film. But it was a law professor of mine, Terry Kogan, was working on a special collection that would archive the material from their medical practice, letters from patients and photos and newspaper clippings. And they'd kept all this, and Maggie had scrapbooked it all. And they were trying to figure out what to do with it. And so they were partnering with the Marriott Library at the University of Utah to create this archive. And that's great. And when I heard about that project, it was the first time I'd really heard about the full extent of what Kristen and Maggie did for HIV patients. And I said, is anyone making a movie or writing a book or doing something that will tell this story in a more compelling way that can get to bigger audiences than just an archive at the library? And they said, no, we're just doing the archive at the library and we'll do a big launch party for it. And, you know, that's that. And so I said, okay, I want to look into making a film about this. And so we met Kristen and Maggie and fell in love with them and decided that, yeah, it was a project worth pursuing.
You know, and I'm interested on also a couple angles I want to talk about. One, there's a third director, Jenny McKenzie. So you have three directors. I mean, often we have, you know, directing pairs. But yeah, a third person. Well, now you've got a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So I want to hear about how the responsibilities were divvied up. So let's talk about that first. Who did what to make this film?
Well, Jared was really the person that was oversaw the whole process. So I guess you can explain what Jenny and I did.
Yeah. So I kind of found the story, and I was in my third year of grad school at the time, doing a JD, MBA, and MFA in film at the University of Utah. So as you can imagine, I had my hands full. But I felt like that was the time to start the story. And I couldn't direct it by myself and produce it by myself because I just didn't have the bandwidth, and I wanted partners because I feel like you have better product that way anyway. And so I kind of cast my net and thought of Jenny McKenzie because we've known each other for years, family, friends, go back a while, and talked to her about it. And she came with us to the meeting to meet Kristen and Maggie. And we just decided that, we were going to work together on that project. And so Jenny was really the force behind the project in pre-production. She looked at all of the various subjects. I mean, they treated thousands of people over their 35-plus year careers, and there were a lot of choices, but we wanted to find subjects that were largely representative of the types of patients they had. And so Jenny really dug into that and found the patients that, or the families of patients that we could talk to. And she led the production process. She organized the shoots and the interviews and got the raw material there. And then Amanda came in during post, and Amanda and I worked with a guy named Ryan Gass, who ended up editing the film. And we kind of put together the narrative arc, hit the story beats. You know, Jenny was involved with that process as well, but really at the end, it was kind of Amanda and myself sharing the creative decision-making in the post process.
Well, now Amanda, and that leads me into the second question that I wanted to ask, which was, how you guys determined where the story would go. You know, I mean, cause, you know, cause there's the larger subject, but you guys also profile Kristen and Maggie to some extent to add that. And I was curious as to whether you guys literally found that in the editing room and said, oh, here is our movie with this footage, or not?
I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways you can go in a story. I think one thing that Jared and I saw eye to eye on is that the story had to really reflect who they were as people. Kristen and Maggie are very pragmatic, as are the nuns of the Holy Cross mm-hmm. Hospital. And they got in there and they just kind of did their work and they did their job. And the reason that this film came about is because they touched so many lives that so many people are thankful for what they did. So we wanted to add a lot of perspective, but we wanted to make the film feel like them, like you were sitting in a room with them, like you were being treated by them, like, you know, you were a member of their compassionate care model. So we didn't focus on their personal life very much. It is a part of the story, but it's not the focus because it's not the focus of their life. So we just kind of kept it you know, straight to the facts, and then bringing in those thematic elements. So, you know, you have to decide, you know, okay, at this point we're going to talk about stigma that surrounded them, and how are we going to introduce that, and how are we going to lead that into, AZT, you know, whatever it is. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a wonderful chronicle exploring what the struggle was here in Utah to combat AIDS and bring awareness to HIV. And I think it also is a wonderful profile of those two. I found Chris and Maggie delightful to watch. Congratulations again, both you two. The film is Quiet Heroes. Again, it plays in the Sundance doc premiere section. And we've been talking to Amanda Stoddard and Jarek Ruga. Thank you. We are back on The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Minji Cheng. And the film we're going to talk about now is Axeda, The Battle of Standing Rock, which is a Sundance doc premiere. We have three guests. We have a couple of our filmmakers and one of the subjects from the films. And I'll let you guys introduce yourselves. Cody, let's start with you.
Hello. My name is Cody. I'm the director of the film Akichita.
Ginger?
I'm Ginger Shankar, the producer of Akichita.
Hi, I'm Natani Means. I am in the film.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Okay. Mitch, why don't you start reading off this?
I don't even know where to start, because I feel like this film was super infuriating and empowering and educational. So many things. And one of the things, I was just so, how you guys could go about capturing all these things and distilling it down to one film is like, that challenge is mind-boggling to me. And I'm just curious how that process was for you, you know, documenting, getting all this footage, like gathering these interviews. Like, I'm just curious at what that experience was like and how you approached it.
Yeah, it was like when I first got out there, I just kind of wanted to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline and, you know, build barricades and blow shit up if possible, do whatever I could to stop them and help. But when I was out there, I had my camera and my laptop, so I just started doing these little clips that we could like export and get online, you know, across social media, to sort of spread awareness and get the word out there of what was going on. And then all these non-native filmmakers started flocking out there. I think there was like at least 50 of them, right, Tani? It was
getting overwhelming.
Overwhelming, and just, you know, that sort of responsibility kicked in when Sundance had reached out to me and Redford Center reached out to me, and they wanted to make sure there was at least one film crew on the ground out there that was going to tell the story from the inside and from the inside perspective. And so at that point, I sort of realized what a responsibility this was to take back our own narrative. So that history doesn't keep on repeating itself.
Well, I think, and also, yeah, I love the fact that you use the word responsibility, because as a filmmaker, there's a responsibility when you're doing a documentary to, you know, kind of present the argument, to, you know, to kind of frame it for an audience. And there's so much, as Minji said, you know, you could have three documentaries, you know, from everything that's going on currently. And it has been. So can you talk about, both of you, Ginger as well, you know, how you've kind of, you know, tried to distill it down so the people that aren't hotly involved in it can kind of process it?
Well, I mean, Cody was out there for 8 months, and he shot, I think we ended up with about 2,000 hours of footage. No joke, you know. So just getting through that, the fact that he and, what, four editors by the time we were said and done got through all of that in about 4 months. So it's unbelievable. And he's an editor first. So that, I think he was also thinking of the film from an editing perspective as well as a director. So it was unbelievable that it came together in 4 months. And the reasoning for that, we had conversations about, let's wait a year before this comes out, but just seeing what's going on with the government and bears ears being taken, the protections being taken away, everything that's going on in all these indigenous fights, this stuff has to come out now. So it was a decision that was sort of made internally that if we don't do this now and we don't start our impact campaign, like, no one's going to be talking about this a year from now, you know? So we just really wanted to push it out now and make sure that the indigenous voices that are out there are getting recognized for it, because they never do, you know?
Yeah, so we haven't really slept in the last 4.5 months.
I was going to say, have you rested
and,
at all?
No. And it was, so I had actually stopped counting the hours around like 1,200 hours. So I'm estimating it's between 1,500 and 2,000. But the reason why we have so much also is because there was quite a few film crews out there that were non-Native film crews, and they heard that there was one all Native produced, directed, shot, edited project out there, and they actually gave us all their footage.
That's incredible.
I think there was 4 different film crews that actually just dumped us everything, which was pretty amazing. And so going about this was like, we'd start off considering like just the different people we filmed with out there. There was like around 25 different characters that we were like looking at, and people told me in the beginning, oh, you need to boil it down to one, or you need to boil it down to two, or you should have one main character. And it's like, the way that this resistance and this occupation was, like there's no like one person that, like, if you were to follow just one person, that would be a horrible document on what we actually all did out there.
Yeah, you'd be getting like 0.1% of the view of what's happening out there and what was happening in those camps. And this was something that was so unique and so amazing, because this is the biggest gathering of indigenous people since the gathering of the Little Bighorn, when the Sioux Nation defeated the United States government and General Custer. So to have all these tribes come together and then just get one perspective of it would be just like a total disservice to the movement, to the cause, to the beauty of the film.
Yep. So that was where the responsibility came in. Also, was like, you not just have a responsibility to tell this story, but like, you got the responsibility to tell it right. Like just follow one person.
That really resonated in all the different perspectives that you gathered with this larger story that you're trying to tell, and the raw honesty of all the different personal stories and what it meant. And also even from like the perspective of the fact that people were fighting between the people who were supporting the movement, the fighting in between those people, that was such an important aspect to share too. The imperfectness or whatever, that it shows the true struggle besides this larger thing that you're fighting.
Yeah, because I mean, we're fighting colonialism and hundreds of years of colonization between us. You know, and it's hard to, once you start to wake up, you start to fight with yourself. And it's like, we don't know anything on the reservation but internal fighting. So they brought that to the camps, and it distracted from the movement, mm-hmm. you know, but eventually we're gonna get it together, I guess.
I feel like that's where you can learn.
And that was one reason why we did show that in there. That was the high hopes for the film, so we can learn from our mistakes, figure out what we did right, what we did wrong, and how we can do it better next time. Mm-hmm. And to just show that if we're to achieve our goals, we all got to learn to work together and respect the diversity of tactics.
Well, this is definitely one of those documentaries where you watch it and you go, how many more people can I show this to? Because, mm-hmm. that may not know, like I know, what is going on. And I hope that it serves as another tool for you to get the word out. And I hope you guys have a long tour with this, because I really hope this word gets out. Again, the film is Oxida, The Battle of Standing Rock, which is a Sundance doc premiere. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And we're wrapping up day 5 of the Daily Buzz on kcpw.org, moviecitynews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and the Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors, Studio Movie Grill, which is opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency. Additional support is provided by Movie City News, The Market in Park City, Ruby Snap, and City Cakes. Our producer is Lanzia Wan.